Have you ever experienced one of those moments where the comforting illusion of your life just suddenly drops away?
Oh, yeah. Like, completely without warning.
Right. A moment where you're basically forced to look in the mirror and see this harsh, inescapable reality about who you are, or, I mean, maybe more terrifyingly, where you're heading.
It is an intensely uncomfortable feeling.
It really is. And most of us will do almost anything to avoid it. You know, we'll scroll on our phones, we'll work longer hours, we'll buy things we don't even need.
All just to dodge that devastating flash of self-awareness.
Yeah. But that precise, agonizing moment of clarity is actually the beating heart of the book we're exploring today. We're looking at James Joyce's Dubliners.
Which is frankly a monumental piece of work.
It is. And I bring this whole discomfort thing up right at the start because, well, there's a trap we all fall into with classic literature. We tend to treat it like some dusty academic requirement.
Like putting it behind glass in a museum.
Yeah, but this collection of 15 short stories is not a museum piece. It's this sharply observed, unsparing blueprint of how a city systematically breaks the human spirit.
Which is an incredibly ambitious project for any author, let alone a really young one. I mean, Joyce was writing these stories in his early 20s.
Right, he was so young.
He was, and he was looking back at his home city with a level of detachment and precision that is almost, well, it's almost clinical.
So our goal for this companion conversation is to kind of map out the architecture of that project. We're going to unpack the hidden layers of this text, looking at the invisible systems of control, the psychological traps.
And, you know, the profound human truths that make Dubliners so enduring even now.
We will be discussing the entire plot arc of the collection, so consider this a spoiler-friendly guide to accompany your reading or your listening experience.
It's definitely helpful to have a map before you go in.
I want to start by figuring out the ground rules of the world these characters are operating in. Because when I first read through the source material, I tried reading the book straight through, and honestly, it felt really disjointed at first glance.
That's a super common reaction.
Yeah, because you go from like a kid wandering around a dark bazaar to a middle-aged drunk guy falling down a flight of stairs in a pub. It almost feels like Joyce was just throwing darts at a board of random Dublin residents.
But there is a very specific architecture here. The structure is actually one of the most brilliant aspects of the collection, and it is entirely deliberate.
Okay, so how did he organize it?
So Joyce sequenced the stories to map the progression of human life. He organized the book into four distinct sections.
Starting with childhood, I'm guessing.
Right. He begins with childhood, which gives us the sisters, an encounter, and Araby. Then he moves into adolescence or young adulthood with stories like Eveline, After the Race, Two Gallants, and The Boarding House.
Okay, so a clear chronological aging process.
Yeah. And from there, the perspective shifts to mature life, examining characters in a little cloud, counterparts, clay, and a painful case.
And then there's a final shift, right?
Yes. Finally, he broadens the lens to capture public life. So that's politics, society, and culture in Ivy Day in the committee room, a mother, Grace, and he culminates the entire sequence with the dead.
When you lay it out like that, it completely changes how you read the book. I mean, the city of Dublin itself basically becomes the central protagonist.
That's a great way to look at it.
You're watching the city age and harden through the eyes of its citizens. We start with the naive, somewhat confused dreams of young boys, and we inevitably end up in the bitter regrets and compromises of middle-aged men and women.
The environment simply wears them down.
But what is that environment? Like, what is the actual mechanism of that wear and tear? Because to modernize, these characters might just seem, I don't know, clinically depressed or annoyingly passive.
That is probably the most common misreading of Dubliners today. Modern readers often view these characters' inaction as a personal failure of willpower. Like they just aren't trying hard enough.
Right, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of thinking.
Yeah, but that completely misses the historical reality of turn-of-the-century Dublin. To understand these stories, you really have to picture a city trapped under the crushing weight of two massive invisible structures.
Which were?
On one side, you have the political and economic dominance of the British Empire. I mean, Ireland was a colony, and Dublin was a provincial capital that was being actively drained of its resources and political agency.
In the other side.
On the other side, you have the pervasive moral and social authority of the Catholic Church. It dictated the boundaries of acceptable thought and behavior for basically everyone.
So it's kind of like being born into a company town where you're paid in company scrip. Everything you do, every ambition you have relies on the very currency that is designed to keep you trapped.
That's an incredible analogy.
Yes. The church and the empire are essentially acting as the walls of a maze. But the real tragedy is that the characters can't even see the walls. They just know they can't seem to move forward.
Right. They feel the pressure, but they can't always identify the source.
Did Joyce write this out of pure spite? Because, I gotta be honest, it reads a bit like someone leaving their small hometown and starting a brutally honest blog to settle scores with everyone they left behind.
Well, while he certainly had his grievances with Dublin, reducing the book to just a personal vendetta kind of flattens his artistic intent.
So what was he actually trying to do?
Joyce stated his purpose very clearly in letters to his publisher. He said his intention was to write a chapter of the moral history of his country.
Wow. A moral history.
Yeah. And he specifically chose Dublin for the scene because he viewed that city as the center of paralysis. He wasn't trying to be merely malicious. He was trying to be fiercely objective.
Like a documentary filmmaker.
Spot on. He wanted to document the meticulously observed details of daily life without an ounce of sentimentality to reveal this profound spiritual and social stagnation.
I want to drill down into that word, paralysis, because it is introduced on the very first page of the very first story, The Sisters.
It sets the tone for everything that follows.
It really does. We have this young boy staring up at the window of a dying priest, Father Flynn, and the boy just keeps repeating the word paralysis to himself.
Like an incantation.
Yeah. He says it sounds to him like the name of some maleficent and sinful being. He's terrified of it, but he also longs to look upon its deadly work. It sets such an unsettling gothic tone right out of the gate.
And Joyce is using that physical paralysis as a direct metaphor for the spiritual decay of the city. I mean, Father Flynn has suffered a series of strokes that have literally paralyzed him.
But there's more to it than just the physical strokes, right?
Oh, yeah. We also learn about his mental and spiritual breakdown. He dropped a chalice during Mass, which is a monumental failure for a priest, and the guilt just broke his mind.
Didn't they find him in a confession box later?
They did. He was later found sitting alone in the dark confession box, laughing softly to himself. He represents the overarching power of the church, but a power that has become decayed, hollow, and ultimately paralyzing to those who try to follow it.
And the boy feels a strange sense of liberation when the priest finally dies, right? Like a brief moment where he escapes that heavy, suffocating influence.
He does. But the devastating thing is that as we move through the stages of life, the characters in the subsequent stories do not escape.
The conditioning is just too deep.
Yeah. The climax of Eveline, which sits in the adolescent section, is maybe the most painful illustration of this psychological trap.
Oh, that story is heartbreaking.
It's a masterclass in the mechanisms of trauma and conditioning. Eveline is a young woman living a life of quiet terror. She works this grueling retail job where her supervisor openly disrespects her.
And her home life isn't any better.
No, it's worse. At home, she lives in fear of her father's drunken violence. She is effectively a servant to her own family. She promised her mother on her deathbed to keep the home together as long as she could.
And then she actually gets an out. A sailor named Frank offers to take her away to Buenos Aires to marry her, to give her a completely new life.
A literal escape hatch.
Right. And the way Joyce writes the ending, she is standing at the station at the North Wall. The boat is blowing its mournful whistle. The engine is running. All she has to do is put one foot in front of the other.
But her brain cannot process freedom. The text describes her gripping the iron railing with both hands in a literal frenzy. She is physically frozen.
It's that paralysis again.
Exactly. She prays to God to show her what her duty is, completely abdicating her own agency. When Frank calls out to her, screaming, "Come," she sets her white face to him, described as being passive, like a helpless animal.
Oh, wow.
Her eyes give him no sign of love or farewell or recognition. The sheer weight of her religious conditioning, her familial guilt, and the deep grooves of her domestic trauma completely override her instinct for survival.
She chooses the familiar hell over the terrifying unknown.
She really does.
That phrase, passive like a helpless animal, just haunts me. It shows exactly how the city breaks people. It isn't just that bad things happen to them, it's that the environment rewires their nervous systems to reject hope.
That's a brilliant way to put it.
And that brings us to the second major concept we need to unpack here, the epiphany. Because the way Joyce uses this word is It's not how we use it today.
No, not at all.
Today, an epiphany is like a light bulb moment. It's an inspiring realization that leads to some positive life change. Like, I had an epiphany and I'm going to start doing yoga. But in Dubliners, an epiphany is more like a structural collapse of your entire worldview.
For Joyce, an epiphany is a sudden spiritual manifestation. It is the moment when the mask drops and a character sees the reality of their situation with unbearable clarity.
So it's not inspiring.
Not even a little. You are correct. These are rarely transformative moments in a positive sense. They do not lead to action. They lead to profound despair. We see this acutely at the end of Araby.
Ah, Araby. It's such a painful depiction of childhood romanticism getting crushed. We have a young boy who is deeply infatuated with his friend Mangan's older sister.
He doesn't even know her well.
Right. But he elevates her to this mythical status anyway. He imagines himself as a knight bearing a chalice safely through a throng of foes in the dirty, chaotic streets of Dublin.
It's all so heightened and dramatic in his head.
And he promises to go to a bazaar called Araby, which sounds incredibly exotic and Eastern to him, and bring her back a gift.
He invests all of his emotional energy into this quest. But reality continually thwarts him. His uncle comes home late and forgets the money.
The uncle is drunk, right?
Yeah, that's heavily implied.
Yeah.
So the boy takes a painfully slow, delayed train. By the time he finally arrives at the bazaar, the magic has already evaporated. The hall is mostly dark. The stalls are closing.
It isn't an exotic Eastern market. It's just a cheap commercial space.
Right. And then he hears a young English woman flirting banally with two men at a stall.
They're having this incredibly inane conversation, like, oh, I never said such a thing. Oh, but you did. The contrast between his high chivalric ideals and this cheap, flirtatious reality is jarring.
It shatters the illusion completely.
The Eastern enchantment just evaporates into nothing more than cheap porcelain vases and small change.
And that's when the epiphany strikes. He stands looking up into the darkness of the gallery, and the narrative gives us this devastating internal monologue. Gazing up into the darkness, I saw myself as a creature driven and derided by vanity, and my eyes burned with anguish and anger.
The structural collapse you mentioned happens right there.
Yeah. He realizes that his grand romantic quest wasn't about the girl at all. It was a product of his own ego. He was playing a game of make-believe, and the adult world has just brutally exposed his vanity.
Let me push back on how we interpret these moments, though. When these characters achieve this level of clarity, doesn't it at least give them a chance to change?
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah, like, if you can see the cage, shouldn't you be able to find the door? Or is Joyce saying that self-awareness is actually worse than ignorance?
If we look at the arc of the Mature Life stories, Joyce really seems to argue that clarity without agency is a special kind of torture. Seeing the cage does not dissolve the bars.
It just makes you hyper-aware of them.
Yes. In fact, understanding the exact nature of your imprisonment while knowing you lack the economic or social power to escape leads to a deep, festering resentment. This tension between ambition and reality is the driving engine of the middle section of the book.
I immediately think of Little Chandler in the story, A Little Cloud. This guy is basically the patron saint of unearned artistic ambition.
He really is.
He is a clerk, a very fragile, quiet man. He buys books of poetry, but is too shy to even read them aloud to his wife. He dreams of being part of the Celtic school of poets. He even contemplates changing his name to T. Malone Chandler because he thinks it sounds more suitably literary.
He is a man profoundly disconnected from his own capabilities. And then he meets up with an old friend, Ignatius Gallagher, who actually managed to escape Dublin for London.
And Gallagher became a brash, successful journalist.
Right. Gallagher is everything Chandler is not. He's loud, confident, worldly. Gallagher sits in the pub boasting about the spicy bits of Paris and the rich women he could marry if he chose to put his head in the sack.
To bring this into a modern context, Little Chandler feels like the guy today who puts entrepreneur and visionary in his bio because he bought a domain name for a dropshipping business that hasn't made a single sale.
That is painfully accurate.
He feels intellectually superior to Gallagher. He thinks Gallagher is vulgar. But Chandler is sitting there nursing a drink he can barely afford while Gallagher is living the life Chandler secretly craves. The mechanism here is jealousy masked as intellectual superiority.
And that jealousy curdles into acute resentment when he returns home. He goes back to his small house, surrounded by the furniture he bought on a restrictive installment plan.
The furniture itself is a trap.
Yeah. His wife leaves him alone to hold their crying infant son. Chandler tries to read Lord Byron to calm himself, to reconnect with his poetic identity, but the baby will not stop screaming.
The noise of reality literally shatters his fragile fantasy.
So he just snaps. He screams at the child. His wife rushes in, snatches the baby away from him, and glares at him with pure hatred.
And Chandler's epiphany isn't that he needs to write a poem. It's a crushing wave of remorse and the terrifying realization that he is never, ever going to escape his little house.
The installment plan, the wife, the crying child, they are the permanent reality.
We see a much darker, more violent manifestation of that same trapped feeling in the very next story, Counterparts. If A Little Cloud is about the failure of intellectual ambition, Counterparts is about the brutal physics of humiliation.
And how it travels down a hierarchy.
Right. The protagonist, Farrington, is a massive, physically imposing man trapped in a menial, copyist job. He is relentlessly belittled by his boss, a small, sharp man named Mr. Alleyne.
Farrington's body is literally rebelling against his environment. He aches for physical violence and the dark comfort of the pub.
He gets humiliated at work to the point where he is forced to issue a public apology to Mr. Alleyne just to keep his job. He is completely emasculated.
So what does he do?
He pawns his pocket watch, literally selling his own time, just to get enough cash to go out drinking and feel like a big man again.
He attempts to purchase the respect he was denied at the office. He buys rounds of drinks for his acquaintances, hoping to project an image of wealth and power.
It's all a performance.
Completely. He tries to catch the eye of an attractive woman in a peacock blue scarf, but she just ignores him. The final blow to his ego comes when he loses an arm wrestling match, twice, to a much younger, slighter acrobat.
So his entire identity as a strong, dominant man is systematically dismantled over the course of the evening.
Which leads to one of the most stomach-turning endings in the collection. The humiliation rolls downhill.
Right. Farrington has been crushed by his boss, ignored by the woman, and physically bested by the acrobat. He returns to a cold, dark home. His wife has gone to chapel, leaving his little boy, Tom, alone.
The fire is out.
And because Farrington cannot strike back at the systems that oppress him, he redirects his smoldering rage toward the only entity in his life weaker than himself.
He beats his own child with a walking stick.
It's so awful to read.
It is. The boy begs him to stop, offering the only currency he has been taught possesses value. He promises to say a Hail Mary for his father if he will just stop hitting him.
It is a bleak, horrifying illustration of the cycle of abuse.
Systemic oppression does not breed nobility. In Joyce's Dublin, it breeds domestic cruelty. The oppressed become the oppressors in your own small fiefdoms.
It is agonizing because you see the exact mechanism of the violence. It isn't random. It is transferred energy. And this transactional view of human relationships, it really permeates the entire city.
Oh, absolutely. Everything is transactional.
Even romance and friendship are reduced to cold calculus. Look at a story like Two Gallants. You have two young men, Lenihan and Corley, walking the streets. But they aren't friends. They are accomplices in survival.
Lenihan is a sporting vagrant who survives by flattering people for drinks. Corley is a police informant and essentially a predator.
And the entire plot revolves around Corley manipulating a young maid whom he disparagingly calls a slavey.
He isn't just manipulating her for physical intimacy, though. The goal of the evening is to convince her to steal from her employer to give him the money.
Well, Lenihan spends the entire evening just wandering around, eating a miserable plate of peas, waiting to see if Corley pulls off the grift.
And the ending perfectly encapsulates the commodification of human life. Corley returns, doesn't say a word to Lenihan, and simply opens his hand to reveal a small gold coin.
That's it. Romance, morality, human connection. It has all been distilled into a shiny piece of stolen currency.
This transactional nature extends to the institution of marriage as well. We see it most vividly in The Boarding House.
Mrs. Mooney.
Yes, Mrs. Mooney, known as the Madam, runs her establishment with ruthless economic calculation. When she discovers that one of her lodgers, a clerk named Mr. Duran, has been having an affair with her daughter, Polly, she does not react with maternal outrage.
She calculates her leverage.
Exactly.
She treats it like a breach of contract. She waits until the precise psychological moment, a Sunday morning, when the house is quiet and the social pressures are at their peak.
She knows everything about Mr. Duran. She knows he works at a Catholic wine merchant's office. She knows he has been building his career for 13 years and is terrified of losing his job over a public scandal.
The scene where Mr. Duran is preparing to face her is brilliant. He is sitting in his room trying to shave. His hands are shaking. His glasses keep fogging up with panic.
That image of the fogged glasses is so potent. It represents his inability to see a way out.
His biological instinct urges him to remain free, to run away, but the invisible walls of societal expectation and economic ruin push him down the stairs.
He isn't walking into a marriage of love. He is stepping into a carefully laid trap.
Okay, I want to pivot here because there is one character who looks at all these traps, the bad marriages, the dead-end jobs, the transactional friendships, and decides to just opt out entirely.
He tries to beat the system by refusing to play.
Let's talk about Mr. James Duffy in A Painful Case, because to me, this story is the most terrifying in the whole book.
Mr. Duffy is a man defined by his boundaries. He lives in Chapelizod, as far away from the center of the city as possible. His room is devoid of any ornament. He arranges his books by bulk.
So meticulous.
Yeah, Joyce gives us this incredible, chilling description. He lived at a little distance from his body, regarding his own acts with doubtful side glances. He has intellectualized himself out of existence.
That line, lived at a little distance from his body, is the ultimate description of dissociation.
It really is.
He meets a married woman, Mrs. Sinico, at a concert. They strike up an intellectual intimacy. They sit in her dark parlor and discuss books and philosophy. But the moment she breaches the physical boundary, he passionately presses his hand to her cheek. He immediately cuts her off.
He writes in his journal that friendship between men and women is impossible because there must be sexual intercourse. It's too messy for him. The variables are too unpredictable.
So he retreats back into the safety of his sterile, controlled routine. 4 years pass. Then one evening, while eating his dinner, he reads a newspaper article.
It is a short, sterile piece of journalistic prose detailing an inquest into the death of Mrs. Sinico.
She was struck and killed by a train at a crossing. The article casually reveals that in the years since Duffy abandoned her, she had descended into severe alcoholism and was wandering the tracks at night.
His initial reaction is incredibly defensive. He is revolted by her degradation. He feels retroactively justified in leaving her, thinking she was unfit to live.
He protects his ego first. But then the defense mechanism breaks down. He goes for a walk through the park where they used to meet. And this is where the epiphany hits. And it is a slow, agonizing realization.
He looks down from the hill, the distant city lights. He hears the goods train winding out of the station like a worm with a fiery head, the engine rhythmically reiterating the syllables of her name.
Oh, man.
He realizes the profound arrogance of his isolation. He withheld life from her. By denying her companionship because it was inconvenient to his sterile routine, he effectively sentenced her to death.
And the final thought of this story is the most brutal gut punch. He felt that he had been outcast from life's feast. We have to dwell on this because the modern parallel is so intense.
How do you mean?
Think about how we live today. We curate our lives through algorithms. We order food to be left at the door so we don't have to talk to a delivery driver. We ghost people when conversations get difficult.
We construct these perfectly controlled, frictionless environments.
Exactly like Mr. Duffy arranging his books by bulk. And the terrifying warning here is that if you succeed in eliminating all the friction and messiness of human connection, you don't achieve peace. You just achieve an early, silent death. You become an outcast from life's feast.
That is a profound connection. The refusal to engage with reality, the preference for a curated illusion over a messy truth, is the ultimate form of paralysis.
And we see this desire for illusion operate on a societal level as well, particularly regarding religion and politics. If we look at the story Grace, we see how institutions themselves become tools for maintaining the illusion rather than dismantling it.
Let's explain what is happening in Grace, because it involves the Jesuits. And to a modern reader, it might seem confusing why a group of businessmen are plotting to send their alcoholic friend to a Jesuit retreat.
It starts with Mr. Cunnan, a commercial traveler whose career is going down the drain. He gets blackout drunk, falls down the stairs of a pub, and bites off a piece of his tongue.
His friends, Mr. Power, Mr. Cunningham, and Mr. McCoy, decide they need to stage an intervention. But their concept of an intervention is entirely performative.
They plot to convince Mr. Cunnan to attend a Catholic retreat designed specifically for businessmen.
The mechanism at play here is fascinating. They discuss the Jesuit order not as profound spiritual guides, but as an elite, influential networking group. McCoy literally says, if you want a thing well done and no flies about it, you go to a Jesuit.
Yeah, it is religion as networking. They are treating salvation like a country club membership. Mr. Cunnan eventually agrees to go, but he draws a hard line. He says he will sit through the retreat, but he refuses to hold a lit candle during the service.
He says, I bar the magic lantern business.
He wants the social respectability of being seen as church, but he actively rejects any vulnerability or genuine faith. He wants the optics without the transformation.
And the church, represented by Father Purdon, accommodates this hypocrisy perfectly. When they attend the sermon, Father Purdon uses a text about the mammon of iniquity.
He essentially tells this congregation of corrupt, compromised businessmen that Jesus understands they must live in the real world.
He frames his role not as a moral judge, but as a spiritual accountant. He's just there to help them tally up their moral ledger so they can go right back to their ruthless business practices on Monday morning.
It's a complete abdication of moral authority. The church isn't saving them. It is enabling their paralysis by granting them a superficial absolution.
And this political and spiritual stagnation is exactly what we see in Ivy Day in the committee room.
I know we touched on the British and Catholic influence earlier, but we need to explain the historical context of this specific story, because otherwise it's just a bunch of guys sitting around a fire doing nothing.
The context of Ivy Day is essential. The men in the room are canvassing for a local election. They're being paid to promote a candidate named Richard Tierney, who is known to be accommodating to the British authorities.
And the tension in the room revolves around two figures. King Edward VII, the British monarch who is scheduled to visit Dublin, and Charles Stuart Parnell, the former leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party.
Parnell is the ghost haunting the room.
For the listener who might not know Irish history, Parnell was a massive, charismatic figure. He was the great hope for Irish independence, pushing for home rule, but he was involved in a scandal of long-term affair with a married woman, Catherine O'Shea.
And when this became public, the British press attacked him.
But more devastatingly, his own party and the Catholic Church in Ireland turned against him. They abandoned him. He lost his power and died shortly after. The people who remained loyal to him commemorate his death by wearing a sprig of ivy in their lapels.
So keeping that history in mind, the men sitting around the fire wearing ivy are supposedly loyal to the memory of Parnell, the great lost leader. Yet they are currently taking money to support a candidate who plans to welcome the British king.
The hypocrisy is palpable.
They argue endlessly about the past because the present is too compromised to examine closely. They recite a sentimental, incredibly mediocre poem about Parnell at the end of the story, not to inspire action, but to comfort themselves.
They use the memory of a dead hero to excuse their own current cowardice and inaction.
It's the political equivalent of Mr. Duffy's isolation. They are hiding in nostalgia.
And speaking of ghosts and the power of the dead over the living, this brings us to the masterpiece that closes the collection, The Dead.
This story is a symphony that gathers up every single motif we have discussed. Paralysis, epiphany, failed ambition, social conformity, and the inescapable weight of the past.
It is widely considered one of the greatest short stories in the English language. It centers on Gabriel Conroy, a teacher and literary reviewer who is attending his aunt's annual Christmas dance with his wife, Greta.
Gabriel is a complex figure. He is highly educated, but he is riddled with social anxiety and insecurity. He constantly monitors how others perceive him.
He is terrified of being misunderstood. He worries that the speech he has prepared for dinner will be too highbrow for the guests. He has an awkward interaction with a servant girl right at the start that throws him off balance. And then he gets completely flustered by a woman named Miss Ivers, who playfully attacks his politics.
Miss Ivers calls Gabriel a West Briton.
This is a crucial historical insult. It refers to an Irish person who adopts British cultural attitudes and political sympathies, essentially rejecting their own Irish heritage.
Gabriel writes reviews for a conservative unionist newspaper. When Miss Ivers asks why he prefers vacationing in France or Belgium instead of exploring the Irish-speaking regions of Galway, Gabriel snaps that he is sick of his own country.
He is the ultimate product of the colonial system. He has internalized the belief that his own culture is inferior, and he seeks validation from the continent and the empire.
He spends the entire party trying to manage his image, delivering his speech, carving the goose, acting the part of the benevolent worldly intellectual. But the true emotional core of The Dead reveals itself after the social performance ends.
As the guests are leaving the house, Gabriel looks up the staircase and sees his wife, Greta, standing in the shadows.
She is completely still, listening to a man named Mr. Darcy singing an old Irish song called The Lass of Aughrim in a hoarse voice.
This is a pivotal moment. Gabriel looks at his wife and thinks she looks like a painting. He views her aesthetically. He feels this massive surge of romantic, almost lustful energy toward her.
He remembers their secret moments, their life together.
He builds up this entire narrative in his head about how he's going to assert his masculine dominance and passion when they get back to their hotel room. He is practically bursting with pride.
They return to the dark, cold hotel room, and Gabriel attempts to initiate intimacy. But Greta is unresponsive. She begins to weep.
When Gabriel presses her to explain what is wrong, the illusion of his marriage and his own self-importance is completely shattered.
She reveals the song, The Lass of Aughrim, reminded her of a young boy she knew back in Galway named Michael Fuhrer.
Gabriel is immediately jealous. He asks if she was in love with him. Greta explains that Michael was in decline, very ill with consumption.
But the night before she was scheduled to leave Galway for the convent, Michael left his sick bed, walked through the freezing rain, and stood under her window to sing to her.
He died shortly after at only 17 years old. And Greta says, with absolute devastating sincerity, "I think he died for me."
The mechanism of Gabriel's epiphany here is the complete dissolution of his ego. He realizes that while he has been living his comfortable, safe, carefully curated life, fretting over reviews and social slights, his wife has been carrying the blazing romantic memory of a dead boy in her heart for years.
He realizes he has never felt a passion so intense that he would be willing to die for it.
He looks at himself in the mirror, and remember, the mirror is our central metaphor today.
He sees a ludicrous figure acting as a penny boy for his aunts, a nervous, well-meaning sentimentalist, orating to vulgarians. The mask is gone.
The West Briton intellectual is exposed as a hollow man. He realizes that a dead 17-year-old boy is more alive in Greta's heart than Gabriel is sitting right next to her.
Which leads to the legendary final paragraph. Gabriel lies in the dark, listening to the snow begin to tap against the window pane.
He imagines the snow falling all across Ireland. It is falling on the dark central plain, on the Bog of Allen, on the mutinous Shannon waves, and finally falling on the lonely churchyard where Michael Fuhrer lies buried.
His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead.
The snow connects everything. The living who are dead inside and the dead who still passionately govern the living. It covers the entire paralyzing geography of the country.
It is an incredibly moving piece of prose, and examining a passage like that brings up a really important point about the medium through which we consume this book.
Yes, the audio aspect.
Right. Reading those words silently on a page is one thing, but Joyce's prose is intensely, deliberately musical. It actually demands to be heard.
The auditory experience is crucial. Joyce possessed a remarkable ear for the specific cadence, vocabulary, and rhythm of Dublin speech.
When you read silently, your brain might gloss over the nuances.
But when you hear it performed aloud, you catch the distinct socioeconomic markers. You hear the sharp, cynical street slang of Lenihan and Two Gallants, contrasting with the snuffling, cautious political gossip of the men in Ivy Day. The language itself becomes a map of the city's hierarchy.
Not to mention the literal music that is woven into the text. Characters are constantly singing, playing the piano, or quoting poetry.
Like in Clay, the elderly Maria sings, "I dreamt that I dwelt in marble halls," and she makes a poignant, unconscious mistake in the lyrics.
Right. She omits the verse about suitors and marriage, which moves her brother to tears. Hearing that song, or hearing the hoarse rendition of The Lass of Aughrim that breaks Greta's heart, it transforms the text.
It shifts from a silent, solitary reading experience into an immersive oral tradition. You feel the atmosphere of the drawing rooms and the pubs.
And that atmosphere, while firmly rooted in the historical reality of 1904 Dublin, carries a profound modern resonance. We have touched on this throughout our conversation, but it bears repeating.
The specific political debates or social constraints might have changed, but the psychological states Joyce is mapping are universal and painfully relevant.
The fear of settling, the creeping realization that you are living a life you didn't consciously choose, shaped by algorithms, economic realities, or familial expectations you never challenged.
The quiet desperation of just maintaining a routine, going to the office, paying the installment plan on the furniture, curating your digital presence while starving for actual connection.
Joyce's Dubliners are everywhere today. We are all navigating invisible structures that demand our conformity.
The central warning of the text remains potent. Seeing the cage does not automatically open the door. Fighting against the bars blindly, as Farrington does, often only injures the prisoner or those closest to them.
And the alternative, practiced by Mr. Duffy or Gabriel Conroy for most of his life, is to quietly conform and protect oneself from the sharp edges of reality.
which leads to a different, quieter kind of death.
So bringing this all back to you, the listener, how much of your life is an unexamined routine?
Are you waiting for a sudden epiphany to change your trajectory?
Do you think a moment of striking clarity will automatically fix the problem? The tragedy of this book is the realization that clarity is not the same as escape. Awareness is only the first agonizing step.
It is a sobering thought. The challenge Joyce leaves us with is to examine the invisible structures that dictate our own choices. Where might you be sleepwalking through your life, accepting limitations simply because they have always been there?
Where are you choosing the familiar paralysis over the terrifying possibility of freedom? It is a lot to process.
It really is.
But there is no better way to truly feel the weight, the heartbreak, and the stark musical beauty of these stories than to experience them as they were meant to be heard.
The Claire Noratio audiobook of Dubliners is a fantastic way to do that.
We invite you to seek it out. Let the rhythm of the Dublin streets and the power of Joyce's prose wash over you. Because until you look into that unsparing mirror, until you let the comforting illusion drop away, you won't know if you are actively moving toward the life you want, or if you're just frozen at the railing, watching the boat sail away.